sake of the person who's running the tape room, I'll say let's roll the tape. My name is Peter Lundholm, and I'm a chaplain at Memorial Hospital in Cambridge, Minnesota. And I'm going to be talking this morning about grief and what is helpful. And in that sense, I'm really going to be looking to you for a great deal for input on what you have found helpful in your own grief response to the losses you have experienced. Grief is, I believe, our natural response to the experience of losses of any kind. So when we talk about grief, they can be larger or greater losses. The process is basically the same. It is, I believe, in many ways, a feeling process. It involves our emotional state. And I also am convinced that our feelings are God-given. I don't always manage that so well myself. I tend to be a fairly rational person. But I am convinced that that's true, that our feelings are a gift of God. An interesting little book in the bookstore that I noticed the other day is a book by Paul Tournier, and it is called The Gift of Feelings. And I encourage you, if you're at all interested, to pick that one up. That's really a helpful and worthwhile book. Loss, as such, I am convinced, is a universal human experience. So we all experience losses of various sorts, and our response to those losses, then, is our grief, which can be more or less helpful or more or less healthy. The handouts I have given you today, first of all, this particular chart is one way of representing the grief process, one way of diagramming it. There are a number of others. I mentioned, I think, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who has developed a kind of a schematic system for describing the kinds of experiences one has in grief. And there are at least two or three others that I'm aware of. This one, particular one, I found quite helpful. It says the most to me, so that's why I use it. But before we begin really looking at that, I would like to have some of you respond by just identifying some losses that you have experienced. Some of you began to do some of that last night. And they need not be major losses. We all have loss experiences. So I leave it to you. What would be some loss experiences you have had?
The greatest loss that I've had is the death of my wife. And it was traumatic.
And then mine, my husband and a child.
Was that particular loss at pretty much the same time, or was that over a period of years?
There was a period of probably 35 years. The baby was 3 months old when she died. That was my first steps with knowing my Lord.
Okay.
And the second was my husband two years ago.
2 years ago.
Loss of job can do an awful lot as far as lowering your self-esteem and where do I go from here. Divorces. I've talked with many people who are divorced here and just devastated. Where do I begin at 59 years old and start over? And, you know, where's a place for me where they're really suicidal and maybe take an overdose just to alarm people I need help? Lots of things like that. Think of my own husband, your dad, who lost his hearing, and his whole work was in the field of music, which was real devastating. Taking that away.
I'm wanting to hear from some others of it. How about the front row?
I lost my father when I was 4 years old. and was put into an orphanage. And last year, my wife felt the need to work on some things within her, and she left home for a year. And my son and I have suffered some feeling of loss.
Mm-hmm. A week before I came up here, my son informed me that he and his wife were going to be divorced. And for a week that was a terrible burden to carry because there are two small children involved. And matter of fact, I only felt like I should cancel this trip because I felt it was leaving too much in the hands of my husband. But since I've come here, I realized that I needed to be here to get away from it because I was too much involved. And something you have to work through. But,
so there was some need for some perspective.
Yes, yes. And I was so close to it, I couldn't see it there. But I can see things now so much clearer than I could when I was back home.
Well, several of you have identified some losses, and I hope others of you will do so as well. What has been helpful for you as you have experienced those losses? And what has not been helpful?
I think the favorite statement that is not helpful was, well, you had so much to be thankful for. Mm. Mm. And I find some days that's awfully hard to sort through.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I know it was intended for good in the process of losing both child and husband.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something you really want to hear. Or it was God's will is another one that's very hard for me.
Okay. Another cliche is, oh, nothing lasts forever. Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a line in Emily Dickinson. It says that for every moment of ecstasy, we must in threefold pay in anguish.
Mm.
I can't hear what you're saying, and I know it's worthwhile hearing.
There's a line in one of Emily Dickinson's poems, and it says that for every moment of ecstasy that we have in our life, we must threefold pay with a time of anguish.
Do you believe that?
Beginning to.
It's a profound philosophical statement, and this, and possibly sometimes works out as being true, but I don't say that it's inevitable.
Has that been helpful for you or not helpful?
Just about everything in life has a price. Your mistakes, your excesses, your sins of omission,
mm-hmm.
and you eventually pay that price. We pay that price when our children go wrong. We pay a price, you see. And it's the price of something we've done wrong, often. Some inadvised parenting.
There certainly are consequences for our choices.
That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I find the scripture that says, in everything give praise and thanks. I can't do it. Or some of it. You know, I know there can be substitutions eventually, and time helps and all that. But it still doesn't erase them, and I just don't thank for that. I don't thank for that loss in my life. It's probably growth experience, and that I can be empathetic with other people around me because of what happened. And that maybe that's one reason for sorrow in the world, is so we can empathize with each other.
I believe you talked last night about the anger you felt or the resentment you felt. What was helpful for you in making some changes with that?
Well, at the time when my wife died, she died of cancer. She suffered for a year. We went to many, many physicians, doctors, surgeons, neurologists. She went through brain surgery. She lost a kidney. She lost her, well, everything. She finally was taken from me. And I was a very bitter man. Bitter to medical people, bitter to the church, my God. It took me 3 or 4 years with the help of our minister to see the light and to realize that we are all humans, physicians, everybody but God. And with the help of my minister, I was able to see the light, and through very physical activity in the church, participating in everything that was possible, I realized that I was not the only one that has suffered in this world, and that to come out of it and realize that God was there to help me and not hinder me. And through the church, and I was able to realize my thinking was wrong, and I have lived a far better life since than I did before.
Do you remember anything in particular that your pastor, your minister said that was helpful in helping you realize that?
Just general discussion, like we have here today. Nothing outstanding or that was stayed out in my mind. It was the general feeling of being active, get back into the church, live the good life, but nothing of any particular item that stands out. It was a general feeling of well-being that came to light. I have since met doctors, physicians, who I have a lot of respect for, and I realize that they have a job just like the rest of us, you, me, everybody in this room, and that they do the best they can with available knowledge, and they're learning every day. And someday I'm sure that, maybe not in my lifetime, but someday there will be some cures that will not have the heartache that we people today have, losing loved ones through some medical problem, or alcoholism, drug abuse. There are many things that we're facing today that hopefully down the road it'll be a better world for it.
Yeah.
Along the line of anger, I don't have a personal experience with it, but I recall having a group in our church for a forum one time that was presented by people who had lost children, I think is what it was. And I remember particularly a lady who was involved with MAD, Mothers Against Drug Crime, mm-hmm. and she had lost a child, and she was very angry. And at first I was a little put off by that, saying, you know, she needs to get through that anger bit. But I saw it coming across as a very constructive thing in her being able to, you know, she's working through her grief, and that this, being involved in this organization, gave her a way to
real constructive outlet for that anger.
And that without that anger, she probably wouldn't be able to be involved in that. I mean, the anger, it was like Jesus throwing out the money changers in the temple. You know, there's anger there that's constructive, mm-hmm. it needs to, but it was the force behind what happened, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not always bad.
Motivated her to get involved with a group like that. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how many of you have been involved with a support group of some form or another in connection with a loss?
Well, I have been a volunteer for the last 12 years with the pastoral care at St. Luke's in the town of Davenport where I live. I had been a hospice volunteer for 10 years working with the terminally ill and their families, which taught me a lot about how to deal with watching my husband die. He died in our home 2 years ago today. And we chose that route because it meant a lot to all of us as a family. And I'm grateful for hospice because of that training. It's been wonderful. Of course, there's pain and I hurt, but I grew a lot.
Okay. That's an important thing, that in time of grief, if you don't grow, you never get over. And I think it's a growing aspect of your mind, your soul, your activities, whatever they are. And I have found that one of the things that keeps me moving is I have become active in many areas. Elderly housing. I was involved in hospital rehab at St. Luke's. But not as much as I should have been. But I really think that until you have gone through grief of an immediate family member for one reason or another, you don't understand the problems that people that have gone through it are going through. You can say, well, that's too bad, and God will take care of you, and God works in strange ways. These are all cliches that really have, in my mind, no merit.
As you talked earlier, my sense was that there was a period of time when you were not involved. How long did that take you to get to that point?
About 3 years. I couldn't accept losing anyone.
But at the end of that time, you were able to do that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a gradual process. Mm-hmm. And my three children were very supportive. Excuse me.
Would it be safe to say at this point in time that you still have some painful feelings about that?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure. Are they less intense than they were before?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Okay. No, it doesn't happen very often. But living alone, there's times when you think about what's going on and what has gone.
Sure.
And memories come back. Mm-hmm.
And there are some things that trigger those memories as well.
Mm-hmm. And yet memories are a valuable tool. A very valuable tool. Mm-hmm. The good and the bad. You don't put them in sainthood, but there is a wonderful, wonderful recall that helps heal. Mm-hmm. And I've learned that in 2 years' time, and I'm still learning it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want the memory to ever go away. I want to find fulfillment in life and give God whatever I have left to give. And that's going to be a challenge.
And has been a challenge.
Oh, you bet. Mm-hmm. But I think with His help, I'll make it.
Other things that you have found helpful?
One thing I did not find helpful was when a lady came to the hospital and said, well, don't worry, you have such great faith. You're going to be able to get through this. And I just looked at her, and I won't say what my mind said to her. I think you'd all be shocked. But I thought, my God, I'm at the very weakest point right now. I mean, I felt I was so helpless at that time. And that's when God is most helpful, is when you are so utterly weak that you have nowhere else to go.
Were there friends that you could confide in that were helpful?
I was so wrapped up in my son at the time that I didn't seem to want anyone to come into that space. I wanted that space alone with him.
It was a very private.
It was a very private experience. And
I talked to Whitmer Marvin up at the hospital. He said, we each have to handle these things in our own way, and this was my way. And I know my pastor came up and wanted me to get more involved and get more people involved, and I said, no, I can't handle that. I want this time alone. It's too precious to me to share with others.
How about since your son's death?
I never had the need to go into a group. They called me from the hospital and asked me if I'd like to. I said no. I think because I had 2 years in advance of preparation, more or less. When I was at the hospital up in Boston with my son, there were groups up there, and I just went in for a brief time and walked out because I couldn't handle that. Everybody was crying on everybody else's shoulder, and I did not want that type of experience. I had, I don't know, I've always been a person that's been pretty well able to carry things within myself with the help of God.
How about in terms of friends since that time?
Have you been able to? Wonderful. The friends that I've confided in. I mean, they're just certain people that I feel at this point in time I need. And your mother's one of them. And another very dear friend was out in New Hampshire. And she and I would call each other quite frequently. She was wonderful. And I didn't want to be surrounded and have so many people around that I was going to get confused.
Has there come a point for any of you that you have needed to kind of tell the story of what happened, either to a group or to selected individuals? Or
I think you have to tell your story. It doesn't really matter in what form or how or when or who to who. Mm-hmm. But I think at least I as an individual have to empty myself of a lot of that carryover, that whether it be forgiving. We had time in my husband's dying to come to grips with a lot of things in our marriage that could have been better, but they weren't, and we had to deal with that. Not verbally, but just in the sharing of being together. And I am grateful for those kind of things. We told each other our stories often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there was a real opportunity for you for some resolution.
Oh, yes. There was a lot of time for the healing for me to begin and for the letting go for both of us. I never dreamed it would be as traumatic as it was, though. We never talked about the final death.
Mm.
And the letting go.
And so nothing really prepared you for that?
No, and I'm not upset about that. I come from a background where I sort of came into the world mothering. I came from a big family and was one of the oldest ones. So that was an easy part for me. I needed that.
Mm-hmm.
I needed that kind of activity to keep me moving for a while. I'm grateful for many, many things in spite of the pain.
How much were you able to share your story?
The last year of my wife's life, we spent many, many days in hospital rooms, many days at home. I think we covered every subject imaginable as far as what was going to happen, how much more time was there, and what should happen to the children. My wife was very close to our family, as I am today. But I think the main thing was that we were able to, spend the last year together, discussing life, God, and
okay. There are no apologies necessary for tears.
Well, these are bad.
you've been upset, even though it's been, almost 11 years.
Sure.
I still feel the...
I think there are quite a few of us can identify with that.
Another real difficulty in loss is when you have to make the decision to let go. Like my husband had life support. And there was no communication, no sign that he'd ever be alive. And how long do you let him be in that state? And a doctor for me came and wanted to redo a process. And I said, wait a minute. It's never going to be so he can even communicate. He wouldn't want to live this way. And I said I had to assure him that I would not sue him. Withdrawal, life support. And luckily, four doctors came in and said, I did the right thing. But I've learned since I came out here, states differ on that, and they will not let you make the decision. And I thought, that's horrible. That would make me feel like I had made him die, you know, like I'd murdered him by making this decision. But I was so glad for the assurance of the doctors at that point that I had done the right thing to say, I want to let him die.
At this point in time, then the living will comes into reality, doesn't it?
Right.
That's a very important tool for all of us, even young people, to remember.
But even that doesn't hold in every state.
Doesn't it apply to all states?
There were people who were out here and they said, it's not that way here.
In other words, by my taking the steps I've taken, my doctor, my attorney, any one of our family, it's in my Bible that please don't keep me alive if I'm a vegetable, has no merit in someone respecting that wish?
Some states, that's true.
That's awful.
I thought so too. I was surprised to hear that.
What about Iowa? Is it allowed in Iowa?
I think so, and I think they'll know it.
You have the choice of
pulling the plug?
Pulling the plug. And my wife and I agreed early on that if she ever got to the point where she was to be a vegetable, pull the plug. And at the end, the doctor said, we can put your wife on some life support systems. Would you want that? And I said, no.
Very difficult decisions.
Oh, yes. It was, but it was a time where we had the advantage of being able to discuss it privately with our pastor, and the conclusion was reached. I told my children the same thing, that if I ever get to the point where I'm in a position where to live, put me on a machine, don't let the doctors do it. And in Iowa, we can do that.
I know that you had talked to that over too.
Right, and we talked with you, and I went to the lawyer immediately afterwards and said, I don't want this to happen. And we have one daughter who's overseas, and it takes a long time if you have to wait for that communication, whether they approve. And I'm going to move out, so I'd run into difficulty with that problem. I didn't want that to happen to us. Peter's the oldest in the family, and he is in charge.
Well, I think you're a lot of your medical people today, though, come forth in this when they see that the inevitable is there. That was one of the first questions they addressed to both of us. How do you feel? Where do you want us to go with this when the time comes?
Okay, so they
I respect them for that.
So they were very honest with you.
Oh, yes, and I respect them for that.
Beginning.
They didn't pull any punches. They laid it all out very... It was horrible to hear. But it was a very valuable thing for us in accepting where we knew we had no choices. I think we do humanity such a disfavor in trying to keep people alive when you know there is no possible life left in that body. It's death. Death is easier. I have a sister who's been a vegetable since 1960. Because in an accident, they tried to save her life. She was literally brain dead from the time the accident happened. She still lays today. And there's where I get into problems with living and dying. because my husband wanted to live, and he was healthy up until the cancer diagnosis came. Mm-hmm. And here's this dear soul who has not known any of us for since 1960.
30 years.
Yes, and you see the evidence of that. And this is where I know I have a deep faith, because otherwise I would just be stomping at my Lord. I will never understand what his plan is, ever. But I know he's there.
This may be an area where the medical profession is not being fair to the rest of us humans in not providing some means legal to take people away from their misery and their hurt. This lady has a family, has had a problem for 30 years, a very expensive problem. And I feel that someday there will be a means that a medical doctor, a family can get together and decide what to do and how to relieve the person of the hurt that they obviously are going through, even though they can't show it or tell us.
I wonder if there are situations where the necessity is to provide medical treatment at the moment. Once that is provided, how do you step back from that?
It's a difficult question to answer.
That's a difficult
question. I'm not sure we don't have the answer at this point in time, but I sincerely hope that someday, in the not distant future, this will be resolved, not necessarily through the legal courts, but through a religious atmosphere. And I think this is where it's going to have to come from. Not necessarily a legal thought, but a religious thought.
I was going to say that hit me when my mother-in-law was dying. And you can believe that you would never put somebody on a support system, but a situation may arise where, you know, an emergency comes up and they're put on that, assuming that they'd be taken off, and then they would be taken off with it. And I had never thought of that possibility, of that ramification until that.
I think of in the instance of my own father's death, given the situation at the time he was hospitalized, naturally the option was to treat what was there to be treated. Once entered into that process, what do you then do? It's very difficult then to stop that. You know, had I been on the scene, I'm sure I would have decided to do exactly what was done. On the other hand, looking at that in retrospect, I know from what I read, did some research in terms of what that treatment entailed, that the likelihood of that succeeding was almost nil. They did an induced coma was part of the treatment, and for a child under 18 years of age, that might be a very valuable kind of a treatment. For a man of 75, there was almost no hope that would provide any kind of relief. Then again, I didn't know that until after the fact.
May I ask this lady, how was your sister receiving nourishment?
Well, she, at that particular time, she was receiving nourishment with the through the veins. Yeah. She was in the hospital for months before they brought her home. It was a horrible car accident, and it just severed across the top of her skull. And we have always wondered, there was days that we felt miracles would be happening and she'd be healed and everything would be fine. And after 3 months of watching the healing, you soon realize that that's just wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought her home, and she's still in her home being cared for by her wonderful husband, who I have not ever heard one complaint from.
Is she able to feed herself?
No, no, no. She can't sit up. She can't stand.
She carries fed through a stomach?
No, no. He feeds her by mouth.
Oh, she can swallow and so forth.
But that's almost worse than death.
Yes.
I want to have us take just a brief look at the chart that I gave you, so that we get some discussion of that or some sense of what this is about. Now, I really appreciate your willingness to share what you have shared. I think it's helpful to look at something like this, although I know and I agree with what you said the other night, that no amount of intellectual knowledge of the process, or of even having seen somebody else go through it, prepares you to do this yourself. It's certainly true for me that I was working as a hospice chaplain at the time when my father died. That didn't spare me from having to do my own grieving. This is something that each of us needs to do for ourselves.
Some people can do it. We all do it in different ways. And therefore, whichever way someone chooses to do it, I say to them, it's right for you. I have a friend that needs people around her. She needs to be doing things. She can't. She doesn't want to take any time to think about what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of feels like maybe you guys should get into this sort of thing. Just you back off. You do your thing, I have to do it my way. We each have to go through our grieving process.
And I think we are each responsible for the way we handle this. Just as we each need to do it in our own way, that way is not particularly effective or healthy, then we live with those consequences.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's also different grieving for a parent than for a spouse or a child.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that has been helpful for me in that has been a statement that I've heard, and that is that when we lose a parent, we lose our past. When we lose a child, we lose our future. When we lose a spouse, we lose our past and our future. I think there are, as you say, different parts of that, and it is different.
But when you lose a child, a mother loses part of herself.
Absolutely. My sense is that part of what makes the difference for us in that is the different ways in which we invest ourselves in a relationship, in a given relationship. And that naturally is different with a spouse, or with a child, or with a parent. And so when we have those kinds of loss experiences, we lose on different levels. Looking at this particular chart, I see these protest and searching, disorientation, reorganization as kinds of common tasks that we all go through in our grieving. No matter what loss experience we have, but we give expression to those things in our own unique ways. So there, in that sense, the protest part of that, we may give expression to that protest in different ways. I see that protest part as a way of holding the reality, a very painful reality, away from us for a period of time. And it's a necessary time that allows us over that period of time gradually to begin to let that reality of the loss sink in. It's necessary. I think it's even an inbuilt part of, God-given part of our emotional system, that we do that. We hold that reality away from us. Denial is a form of that. Shock and the numbness are a part of that. I know Bayou said you didn't feel any particular anger or haven't expressed any particular anger.
I may have had that anger when I first heard about it 2 years before.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised. I can't remember that. But I may have had that anger then when I first heard about it. But as time went on, I, especially in his presence and...
And at that point, that anger was a needed kind of feeling. Anger can sometimes be a way that we protect ourselves, that we, again, hold that painful experience away from us. There comes a time when that is no longer effective and no longer needed. It's important that we move on from that. And then we get into that searching framework. And I see that as a way of really confirming the reality of the loss experience for ourselves. When we lose something, and this is pretty simplistic and mundane even, but the way that we confirm the reality of the loss is to look for what we lost. And I think we do that in a multitude of ways in our grief. There's a searching that happens on an emotional level. There's even a kind of a physical searching that I think we sometimes carry out. Even the question, you know, why did this happen? I think is part of that emotional searching that we do. I think one of the things that we lose when we have a significant loss is that we lose also the sense that somehow this world hangs together and makes sense. At least that's my experience. This just doesn't seem right, or how can this happen? So we lose on that level. A real graphic example of this for me was a young man whom I worked with in treatment several years ago. Had had many good things going for him. Wife, family, new home, excellent job, stopped at a bar on his way home, took off from the bar on a gravel road, hit a turn, rolled his car, lost his eyesight. And in the course of that recovery from that accident, lost his wife, his family, his home, his job. So there were a multitude of losses as a part of that single loss experience. But he talked with me about how he went back down to that stretch of gravel road, that curb, and walked up and down that stretch of road with his guide dog. And he said, I was looking for my eyes. I think we, many of us, do that in one form or another. Look for what we lost or whoever we lost.
A couple that I know that can't bear children and they're getting on, you know, like they're 35 or 40. Hmm. They're involved with a children's group, socially, social group. You know, the wife tells me, those are my children.
Sure.
And I know another person, Colleen Bourbon in Bellingham, that lost a child when she was very young, and she works for Family Focus now, but a runaway teenager. She says, those are my kids. I say, why didn't you get married and have more children? She says, those are my kids. So there's a replacement, like you were saying, you go looking for your loss. He's looking for his eyes. Tom Stein, that was here teaching, said, told me he spent the last 12 years looking to replace the wife that he lost. And hasn't found her. Mm-hmm.
I want to suggest that can be real risky, too, looking for a replacement.
Marriage on the rebound?
Sure. Or a replacement of a child. I mean, realistically, how can one really do that?
Some people adopt.
Sure. But ultimately, that really doesn't replace the loss. You know? It may give one the opportunity to parent and be a parent and express love and be in that kind of relationship. But there's no way of somehow filling that hole that is there, you know, the absence of the person. I don't know any way to do that.
Well, sometimes if you try to do that, that could wreak tremendous problems for the person that that's close to.
Exactly.
Child or spouse the expectations that,
sure,
they would fill.
That they would fulfill that role.
I think too that it is good, and I don't know if this applies to everybody. One reason I wanted to come back here, I was here 24 years ago with both my boys. And both of them, this was a place that they've always talked about all the years. I'm coming back there someday. And one of the last couple of years before Cal died, he says, Mother, you and I have to go back to Holden.
Mm.
And that was the one place he wanted to come back to.
Mm.
And I thought, should I go back or shouldn't I? But something told me, go back. You've got to face it. Go back. Not because I'm looking for him here, but it's just that this is a place where we found so much love and joy, and it's here yet. I'm not looking for him, but I do know that there's a presence.
It is, because her and I have the same rooms and we can share a lot of things together.
Mm-hmm.
And no one, that was an assignment I think our Lord gave her and I. Mm-hmm.
Since we don't know what happens after death, who knows, maybe her son is with her this week.
Oh, I feel very strongly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think some our spiritual pilgrimages can often be that kind of thing. The disorientation part of this, there's a little book by a chaplain by the name of Bill Miller, who lives and works in the Twin Cities, a little book called When Going to Pieces Helps Hold You Together. And I really think that that's what this is about. Sometimes we have to let go and go to pieces in order to begin to pull ourselves back together again. And that is, I think, in many ways, probably the most painful, most difficult part of grieving. That is not something that I would wish on anybody. But I also believe that this is a necessary part of the experience. It's a time when we are particularly vulnerable. Vulnerable to things like development of cancer, like increased rates of infection, our immune systems are impaired. It's a time when people do have some suicidal thoughts, may even have hallucinations, and then wonder, am I losing my marbles altogether? But it's a very necessary part of the experience. And it's only when we can do that, that we can begin to, as it describes in the chart, that we can begin to put things together again, to reorganize. We can't begin to have life again until we can let go. And so this is really, really important. Lots of depression, like I said, sleeplessness, so forth, that are a part of that experience, but very necessary. And then reorganization. It is a time to put things back together again. And I like particularly the way that you talked about it, was that you got active and you can begin to invest yourself in things you couldn't for a period of time. And that's really a good indication of what happens in healthy grief.
I think it's going to be the same.
Sure. And you needed to get to that point, but you couldn't until you were ready to.
That's right.
Sure. Yeah. One of the things I see happening There are some things that are characteristic of that, and I've listed them here. One of the things that I see happening in that is we're able to see both the positive and negative aspects of situation or person that we have been involved with, that our loss has been a part of. And you talked about that in terms of, you don't see him as a saint.
No more than myself.
Sure. You can look back at that, at your relationship and say, there was good and there was bad. There was some wonderful times and some painful experiences. And that's very healthy. That's really appropriate.
I think I can give a lot of that growth thought pattern to going through the befriender training. And the things I gained that taught me a little bit more about myself, which was in the early 80s that I took the training. Mm-hmm. But you do get a better insight on who you are as a person by taking that kind of a course.
Exactly.
Can you explain a little about that? I'm not familiar with.
Well, we have the wonderful course, this particular chaplain, and I'm sure you probably know him very well. Chaplain Whitmore has been the instigator. He's written many books. He's very knowledgeable, and he's an inspiration to all of us. It's a 26 weeks course once a week, and it's basically a study of your inner being that teaches you to listen to what someone else is trying to say. Ironically, and I'm not going to apologize, I think I needed to share with the group this morning what I've shared, but it is a beautiful thing to go into a setting and listen as a trained person. Mm-hmm. You never stop growing. It's wonderful. I highly recommend it. I have gotten back into my hospice role as a volunteer because I know where they're coming from. And I think it's a necessary thing for me to hang on to. Mm-hmm.
And you were ready to do that.
I had to do it. I just had to do it. Okay.
But the Befrienders isn't a fix-it kind of program.
Oh, no, you know, no. It's the only thing you offer is your ears.
And let the people be where they're at.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I have the most interesting lady right now. I just adore her. She's going to cause me grief. I'm going to, when I have to watch her final stages, because she is terminal. Maybe I will go through grief all over again, but right now what I'm learning from her is invaluable.
Just finally, just to share with you the onion, I don't know that we need to say a lot about it. But like an onion, if we take a layer off, there's another layer beneath. And there are losses, many losses within a given loss. I share this with you just as what I hope is some helpful information. I don't think it hurts to see that. I don't.